This case is a landmark case. It's changing the entire appearance of how Indian Country will look. We want to change the way our lives are controlled by the United States government. That is the big issue.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Eloise Cobell is a banker. She co-founded the Blackfeet National Bank, the first bank on an Indian reservation. Cobell sued the U.S. government for $27.5 billion in assets missing from the Indian Land Trust. And she won. And won. And won. A settlement has now been negotiated, but it's being blocked by the U.S. Senate. Eloise Cobell tells her story.
I grew up on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, and my father moved my mother when he married her out to his allotment from the Dawes Act. He built a small little lean-to and began the family there. And there was 9 children, and we lived out on the reservation. Of course, we didn't have running water, no TVs, but our relatives and friends, our neighbors, would come and visit and always talk about that they couldn't get their money. Well, I saw the farmer take off a truckload of grain off of my property, but I don't get any money. You know, I have oil wells, but I don't get any money. And being a very young person at that time, I had not a clue, you know, what it was all about. But you know how you store something in the back of your head, and then all of a sudden it resurfaces? Fast forwarding my life, I ended up becoming the treasurer of the Blackfeet Indian Tribe in the late 70s, and I had an accounting background, and I started getting statements in from the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, on the tribal trust accounts, and I began reviewing them, and I was like, I couldn't believe that we were earning a deficit interest. And I knew, according to the regulations, is that we could only, the government could only invest our monies into guaranteed securities. So the only way that you could earn deficit interest if the government was going broke. And I knew that wasn't happening. And so I began writing letters. And finally, there was one congressman out of Oklahoma whose constituency was really affected by this entire issue. And he began holding hearings. And every time we'd have a hearing and go in and testify, we'd find out more and more information. And it was through that process we were able to get the United States government to mandate that the Department of Interior had to reconcile, audit, and certify all the tribal trust accounts and individual Indian trust accounts. And I think it's really important to understand that this trust was forced on people. The Dawes Act took land that was already owned by Indian tribes, but there was a group of senators in Washington that called themselves the Friends of the Indians, and they wanted more and more control of Indian land. And if it stayed in a total ownership by the tribe, then they knew that they could not get control of it. So they created the Dawes Act and divided the existing land that was owned, for instance, at Blackfeet, into parcels of land distributed to individual Indians to make them farmers. Senator Dawes said, we've got to teach these Indians about the sunshine. We've got to tell them that they've got to put seeds in the ground and let the sun shine on the seeds so they can all become farmers and prosperous. Well, how would you ever even start? You didn't have the equipment, you didn't have the capital, and they were very strategic about the allocation of this land. They would allocate a piece of property like at Blackfeet up near the mountains and the other piece at the eastern edge of the Blackfeet Reservation, which would be 100 miles apart. How could you even get to that particular location to understand what it was all about? But basically, the Department of Interior came in and said, okay, you Indians are all stupid. We started our trial like this. We had a quote from the secretary at that particular time that said, you Indians are all stupid. You don't understand. So we are going to manage this trust for you to the highest fiduciary standards. I found out that the United States government Department of Interior didn't even have an accounting system. They had never, ever audited these funds from 1887 forward. And we were able to get an allocation of money, so the Department of Interior was mandated that they had to go in and look at these accounts. And what they found out immediately through this huge accounting firm that they hired was that, my God, these tribal trust accounts are in such poor shape that we can only go back 20 years. And we can't do an accounting. We can only do a reconciliation of what the government says came in and what the government says went out. But if you think the tribal trust accounts are in poor shape, the individual Indian accounts are even worse. So as a result, they just put that on the back burner. But I remembered the days when I was a young girl and I heard everybody talking about, I can't get my money, and why can't I get my money? I remembered, as treasurer of the Blackfeet tribe, many elders coming in asking me to help them, to write letters for them. I can't get my money. I need money for my kids to buy them school clothes. My husband is sick. I need to take him to the hospital. I remembered that. And so I continued to ask Congress, well, what are we going to do about the individual Indian accounts? I continued to ask the Department of Interior, what are we going to do about the individual Indians that owns these lands and this is their money? What are we going to do about that? Because I knew that the tribes had accountants, they had lawyers, and they could fend for themselves. But many people in our Indian communities didn't know how to fight back. I was really a Pollyanna. I guess I was raised on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, and I didn't have not a lot of experience in Washington. When I went to Washington, I remember I said, if I can only get to the president. I pounded on all the doors. Finally, one point in time, some really smarty with the Department of Interior said, well, why don't you just sue us? So you know what I did? I sued him. I didn't have the money, of course, but I was fortunate enough to be on the board of Women in Philanthropy. And we used to talk about, you know, what's important in your life, what's going on in your career, what's going on in your personal life, if you wanted to share. And I had no personal life. I was fighting the United States government for an accounting. And so every time I talked about the case. And so everybody was so engrossed in this case. They just became just part of my whole team. And we'd have quarterly meetings. I'd fly to New York and everybody would just forget everybody else. And they'd say, okay, tell us what happened, you know. I said we were more popular than Survivor. It was so great. So when I finally drew the line in the sand, I said I was going to sue the United States government. I didn't have a cent. And then this one group of women said, we will hold a forum of funders and we will help you. We will help you try to raise the funds to bring on this lawsuit. I raised $11 million, which is not nearly enough. You know, ran out of money, you know, quite some time ago because we just didn't expect it to go this long. We haven't paid attorneys from 1999 forward. And when you're working on an issue like this, everybody has got to understand it's not a get-rich one. It's about how you believe in this country and how it should work. And that's, I think, what the dedication of the attorneys and the accountants are that have been working on this case. I went out and I found the best financial attorney in this country. He had never worked with Indians before. That was really important to me because of the fact is that when you're dealing, and excuse if there's any politicians, with those sleaze bags in Washington, D.C., you have got to make sure that nobody trades you off for something else. So I wanted to make sure that I hired somebody that was only dedicated to this case. Dennis thought he was going in to a meeting with East Indians. He thought they'd all have turbans because people think we're poor. And he was shocked because he knew what happened when people mismanaged and lost records and stole records in a private trust, in the private sector. And we know who's getting rich off of these broken systems. We know who's at the trough, and it certainly isn't us Indians. It's big oil. It's people that have been able to use these resources for free for 100 plus years. And that's why the United States government would dig in so deep against us. I mean, we know for a fact that the Attorney General, the White House, everybody's involved now. They have dug in so deeply. And our attorneys, they're there for the commitment. Otherwise, we wouldn't have them. And we have five attorneys. And we're up against armies. And that's why I continue to say the stars are aligned for us because we're winning every single court case because we are so right. And so this should be like a topic that everybody understands because I think it affects not only Native people, it affects all of you in your communities. If the government is allowed to behave like this, get away with this, what will happen? We've got to make the United States government accountable.
Eloise Cobell is a Native American banker, suing the U.S. government to account for an estimated $27.5 billion unpaid from individual Indian trusts since 1887.
So I went to Washington the weekend before June 10th, 1996, and I went for a walk. And because I was pretty nervous, and I walked up to the Lincoln Memorial, and I was looking down at government. Oh my God, cement buildings after cement buildings, and I said, "Oh my God, I'm taking on the United States government," and I just got goosebumps all over, and like I ran back to my room, and I just said, "You know, I can't do this. I can't do it. I am so scared." And so I picked up the phone and I called a friend. And my friend said, I said, "You know, I can't do this. I'm so frightened. And I know the government, you know." And that was one of the problems, I think, that many of the people when I was a young person couldn't go any further to ask the questions, where is my money? Where, you know, how do I get my money? Because they were frightened of being retaliated against. And my friend said to me, "Well, Eloise, if you don't do it, who will?" And I thought, you know, you're right. I hung up the phone. I've never looked back since. Let's talk about some of the victories that we've won. Right off the bat, we held two secretaries in contempt of court, Secretary Babbitt of Interior and Treasury Secretary Rubin. They were held in contempt of court for destroying documents. And then we were able to hold Secretary Norton in contempt of court. She appealed, and the appellate court came down with the decision and said that we should have held her in criminal contempt instead of civil contempt. But the sad part is she got away with it. I mean, she got away with not having documents. But, you know, there are armies and armies of attorneys that are against us. When we walk into a courtroom, we have the Department of Interior attorneys, we have all the Department of Justice attorneys, we have all the Department of Treasury attorneys, and then through Congress, every person that we've charged them in contempt of court, we haven't went to trial yet, were able to go out and hire their own private attorney firm to represent their misdealings with us. We all know what happened to Enron, WorldCom, is that they went straight to jail. And in our situations, do you know what happened to the secretaries that were held in contempt of court? They were fined $600,000, but who paid it? Us taxpayers paid it. Can you believe that? Why isn't people all excited about this? You know, why in there, when there's cuts over health and there's cuts here, they're hiring armies of attorneys to fight. So there's no sanctions against these people that are doing this horrible injustice to the poorest people in this country. And what are we doing about it? Why are we getting so lazy? Where are those buses? Let's head to Washington. You know, even my own people, there is so many things that we need to expose about what's happening with the mismanagement of these trusts. I just visited a place in Navajo a couple weeks ago, going out to update everybody on this lawsuit, and there was like four gas wells in the backyard of these people's land, and they were receiving $154 a year. And they said since the lawsuit was filed, then it's been up to around $900 a year, but we know that it's much more money. But they negotiated these leases. Sometimes people would have a thumbprint on a lease, and it would be for 100 years in just a thumbprint because people didn't understand. Some portions of our case will go far enough back to get, for instance, a piece of property, like the lady where the oil was coming out of her land and all of a sudden it switched off and they didn't own it anymore, and how much was owed, you know, millions of dollars. We can go back to that piece of property when it was owned by that individual and then and come forward, and that's part of our case. But what do we do about the Navajo woman that has a pipeline going across her land that is paid $40, and you make one step and go off to non-Indian land and they're paid $400 and $500? That's not part of our case. And it's sad because that's the trust asset part. And we hopefully will be able to get people some representation so they can fight that case. That's a damages situation. In our case, it's not about damages. We didn't file it that way. We were able to win every single part of this case, but the first part that we had to prove was breach of trust. The government argued that they didn't have to give us an accounting, because this trust that was set up, it wasn't like a private trust. We don't have to have the same standards as other trusts do. But the district court ruled in our favor, and that common trust law standards prevail. And the appellate court ruled even further. The appellate court said common trust law standards prevail, and you're going to go back from 1887 forward with an accounting. This is what happens in Washington. But immediately, the Department of Interior ran to Congress. Remember when they were having all the fires and they were allocating money to fight the fires? They added a rider on that says that they could stay the accounting. And so they approved that rider, and they were able to stay the accounting until December of 2004. And then the judge, who's an excellent, fair judge, ruled that they have to come forward with an accounting plan to account for monies. Well, the accounting issue is a huge issue in our case. It was from 1887 forward. Well, we know they destroyed documents. We know they get up before the court and lie. And they'll say, oh, well, we can do a sampling, you know. Well, we all know what they're going to do. They entered reports to the judge and said, we fixed the systems. All of a sudden, their inspector general, their own inspector general, comes out with a report that says, my God, these security systems are so bad, anybody can hack into them. I mean, anybody can hack into these systems. They can move things around. They can move Indian money around. They can move it. I'm a banker. I know that there is like 2,000 hits a minute, people trying to access financial information. So here you have a system with absolutely no firewalls, nothing to protect these assets. And then they say, no money is missing, Congress. You know, we can't find evidence of anything missing. We needed to do an alternative methodology of accounting. We needed to hire the best oil and gas accountants. We needed the resource accountants that are out there for timber, for everything, because we had to recreate what happened. And fortunately, in 97, there was a man in New York City that picked up the New York Times and was reading the story about the MacArthur Award that I received. And he calls his, at that time, program officer, who happens to be in this room, and said, do you know this Indian woman from Blackfeet who just received this MacArthur Award? And she said, no, but I read one of the most powerful decline proposals from her. And he said, pack your bags, we're going to Browning, Montana. They came to Browning, and I was so scared because I hadn't really met with anybody that was a funder right in my home turf. And he sits across the table from me and said, if we were to give you some money, what would that be for? And I said, for accounting. I need to hire accountants. And he says, well, how much do you need? Underneath my knees were knocking and everything. It's like, how much do I ask? It's like, about $1 million. You know, I just said it really fast. And it's like, okay, you know. And left, and pretty soon he called me and said, well, I know you need more than that, so we're going to maybe give you $2 million. And I was like, oh, my God. It was just like having a heart attack. But that sacred relationship is the most powerful thing that anybody could ever have, because that foundation stayed with us through the thick and thin of what we've been through and was there to support us. And if you don't have that, then we could never be where we are today. We could never have the whole United States government in Washington, D.C. talking 90% of their time about the Cabell case. What are we going to do about the Cabell case? You know, we found the government in breach of trust. We won accounting from 1887 forward. We won where they have to fix all the accounting systems. They have to put systems in place. We won every single thing. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, this lawsuit is about three simple things that nobody here will ever have to file a lawsuit for. Because I know, I'm a banker. I know how trusts are managed. Is that first, we have to compel the United States government to put accounting systems in place because they manage our money and our lives. The second part of this case is to give an accounting to Indian people so they know what they own, what are their assets. The third part of this case is to make restitution. It is not about damages. It's when you adjust those account balances, then give the money back to the people who own it. That is how simple this case is. That's what we're fighting for. We have won every single one of these victories, but have they done anything? No, they have not. Senator McCain, who I thought was really my good friend, he introduced the bill to settle this case because it's just taking too much time. I mean, this Cabell case is just taking too much time. We got to get rid of this. We got to settle it. Well, we're not the people that are the wrongdoers in this case. It's the government, you know, and he introduced this piece of legislation that took away everything that we won in court. It had a money figure like like 11-digit figure, and we're like with X's, 11 digits. Okay, that was supposed to satisfy us. We're only going to do an accounting from 1994 forward. After I read that bill, I said, my God, this is the Baker Massacre. The Calvary came into the Blackfeet and said, okay, we're going to all keep you safe, and you just got to surrender. And thank God, my great-grandfather, who was mountain chief, was not going to surrender. And he was hiding out in the mountains, and he was not going to conform to what the government wanted us to be. So they were able to get other chiefs to say, okay, yes, and we'll give you this piece of paper, and if you hold this piece of paper up, the government will not bother you. And they believed. Here came the Calvary, led by Major Baker. Chief Heavy Runner ran out, and he held the piece of paper up and waved it, and they came in and they killed them all anyway. So that's basically what it's like. If we don't continue to keep ourselves educated and on edge all the time, that they will surround us and they'll kill us. I mean, we have to keep ourselves abreast, and it's hard in our communities when we're suffering and people are just worried about the basics of life. Writing to Congress and saying we're not going to allow this to happen anymore. Well, let me tell you, oh man, Senator McCain was so mad at me. He was pointing his finger at me, and he's like, oh, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing, and you're just doing it. It's like, I'm so getting, I guess, thick-skinned and calloused from these people anymore that you just don't believe them. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry, senators, that I hurt your feelings, you know. But, I mean, it's a mentality that we've got to challenge. We had a Navajo lady, Mary Johnson, testified. She could not speak English. She only spoke Navajo. And she, I fortunately was able to visit her at her home. Oil companies came in. They ran pipelines over the top of her land, so she couldn't even get to her house. She had to go way around her house. In no other place would they ever allow that to happen. She had oil wells pumping in her backyard that contaminated this little tiny spring that came down to feed her goats and her sheep, and they died. And then she went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to report it, and to the Department of Interior. My animals have died. You know, I can't get into my home. I have to move out of my home when the sweet gas fumes come out. They're so strong. And nothing happened. So when she testified at the end of July in our case, she testified in Navajo that her husband and her said, well, you know what, if there's no money coming off of these wells, why don't we just go turn them off? So they took their little toolbox up there and they shut off those wells. And she said, and in a few hours, the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, police, and everybody, oil company, were all out there, and they said, what did you do, you know, ready to haul them off to jail? And they said, well, you said there was no money coming from them.
Eloise Cobell, recorded at the National Network of Grantmakers in 2006. Senator McCain's offer to settle for 11 figures, meaning at least $10 billion, never passed the U.S. Senate. The Obama administration negotiated a settlement in 2009 of just $1.4 billion to settle the claims, plus $2 billion to straighten out land ownership issues and a $60 million federal Indian Education Scholarship Fund. As of August 2010, however, the Senate had twice blocked authorization of this payment. For more information, visit www.cobellsettlement.com. Wings thanks the Making Contact Women's Desk, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. Our email is wings@wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.